นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิThought I'd start today following up with that reference I mentioned yesterday, which was about being one with everything and such like, and the allness of the all. So that was indeed from the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. That's the first discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya. And so that the... Briefly, the passage reads, Bhikkhus, the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, directly knows earth as earth. Having directly known earth as earth, he does not conceive himself as earth. He does not conceive himself in earth. He does not conceive himself apart from earth. He does not conceive earth to be mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? Because he has understood that delight is the root of suffering and that with being as condition there is birth. And that for whatever has come to be, there is aging and death. Therefore, because through the complete destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up and relinquishing of cravings, the Tathagata has awakened to supreme full enlightenment, I say. And so so too with the other elements, with the water as water, with air and fire and so on and so forth, many different categories. And then the last couple, as I recall in the list, are he knows the all as the all, having directly known all as all. He does not conceive himself as the all. He does not conceive himself in the all. He does not conceive himself apart from the all. He does not conceive all to be mine. He does not delight in the all. And then the last one is Nibbana. He directly knows Nibbana as Nibbana, does not conceive himself as Nibbana. He does not conceive himself in Nibbana, does not conceive himself apart or coming from Nibbana. He does not conceive Nibbana to be mine. He does not delight in Nibbana. Why is that? Because he's understood that delight is the root of suffering. And that with being as condition, there is birth, and that for whatever has come to be, there is aging and death. Therefore, bhikkhus, through the complete destruction, fading away cessation, giving up and relinquishing of cravings, the Tathagata has awakened to supreme full enlightenment, I say. So that's the first sutta of the Majjhima is very, very long and involved and has many subtle qualities to it, but that's one particular aspect. And so I thought I would share that with you to follow up that reading yesterday. Any questions on that before we start on the Lumpur Sumato reading? Okay, so the next one in this collection, chapter 7, is called All the Time in the World. This is from the Ajahn Sumedho anthology, and the talk is one of the ones given in the winter retreat of 1988. As we sit here during this retreat, we have to pay attention to the things that are not at all interesting. They may even be unpleasant and painful. To endure things patiently rather than run off to find something interesting is a good discipline. To be able just to endure the boredom, the pain, the anger, the greed, all these things, instead of always running away from them. Patience is such an important virtue. If we have no patience, there is absolutely no possibility of becoming enlightened. Be extremely patient. I liked the kind of meditation where I could sit and grow very calm. And when pain would arise in the body, I'd want to get rid of it so that I could stay in that state of calm. Then I began to see that wanting to get rid of pain was a miserable state of mind. Sometimes we sit for several hours, sometimes all night long. You can run away from physical pain, but after a while you begin to come to terms with it. I've used practices like having all the time in the world to be with pain, rather than trying my best to get rid of it in order to come back to my, quote, real, unquote, meditation. I take time to be with the pains in my body if they come up in consciousness, rather than thinking, how can I get rid of them to get some bliss? Somehow, saying, I have all the time in the world, the rest of my life, to be with this pain, would stop the tendency to want to get rid of it. My mind would slow down for long periods of time, without following or creating a desire. Some of you have this idea of conquering pain, getting over the, quote, pain threshold, unquote, but that's a disaster. So it's a very short talk, this one, but it contains very significant principles, and that the advice that the Buddha gave, the very first, exhortation on discipline for the monastic community was to a spontaneous gathering of 1,250 arahants in the bamboo grove. And the opening encouragement, or the opening line of the Dhamma talk that the Buddha gave on that occasion was Kanti paramang tapo titika nibbanang paramang vadanti buddha. Patient endurance is the supreme practice. Nibbana is the supreme Dhamma, so all the enlightened have said. So that even to 1,250 arahants, he's still giving that encouragement that patience is the great virtue. And in that Kanti paramang tapo titika, tapas is like a supreme austerity, or a way of developing wholesome karma, of burning up defilements, or letting go of the unskillful. And so this quality of patience is an essential element of spiritual training. It's one of those words in English that when we talk about being patient, it brings with it a sense of gritting your teeth. You're waiting for the painful thing to be over. And so patience is taken as a kind of strength, or a sort of a doggedness, I can stand this. But the way that the word is used most commonly in English is that it's a negative state of mind. It's a painful state of mind. You're not going to budge. So there's a virtue to it. There's a wholesome quality, but there's also a sense of waiting for the painful to be over. You're just sort of dug in, and you can endure it, but you've got gritted teeth. And that when the painful experience is over, mental or physical, then you'll be happy. So being patient is a way of, using resolution and determination to get through painful, unpleasant times. So the paramita of Kanti is somewhat different. And so when we think about the paramitas, they are the spiritual qualities. The 10 paramitas are those, spiritual virtues, spiritual qualities, which enable the heart to transcend dukkha. So they're the great spiritual strengths that we have available. So patience as a paramita, it's a radiant quality. It's a liberating quality. So it's not just that sense of doggedness, or sort of gritting your teeth being sort of determined to not budge through the painful experience. But the way I most like to characterize it is true patience, which is a paramita, is letting go of time. It's that the mind is not creating a future. So to be truly patient, you're not waiting. To be waiting is a state of suffering, I would say. And so that true patience is being present with what is and not waiting for it to be over. And so that's a radiant state of mind. There's still a painful, uncomfortable quality there in the realm of sensation, but the mind is not creating any kind of suffering around it. You're not counting the minutes waiting for it to be over and say, I'm not going to budge, whatever happens. And just sort of enduring that suffering, which is, in a way, there's some skillfulness in that, in not being reactive or just running away from the painful feeling. But it's not a transcendent state. I would say that kind of just gritting your teeth and bearing it is not a way of transcending dukkha, but rather, you know, learning to endure it. But the quality of patience and this sense of having all the time in the world, it's letting go of time, letting go of there being any kind of a future at all. And as I was mentioning the other day, one of the comments that Lumpur Cha would make from time to time was that a samana, one who is given their life to spiritual training, has no future. And to our ego, to our self-centered patterns of thinking, no future sounds like a disaster. It's a sort of depressing, nihilistic point of view, or a punk rock song. I forget whether it was the Clash or the Damned or the Sex Pistols, but anyway, no future. It was a kind of nihilistic criticism of life. But from the point of view of the citta, then it's when the heart opens to the timeless quality of Dhamma, of reality, then that's the fact of it. There is no future. Dhamma is timeless. It's akaliko, sanditiko, apparent here and now, akaliko, timeless. So that true patience is based on opening the heart to that timeless quality. There's no past, no future, there's just this. The heart is open to this present. And that, as Lumpur is describing here, then we can use these kind of forms of reflection, these sentences that are little reminders or statements we make to ourselves. You know, I have all the time in the world to be with this painful feeling. I have all the time in the world to be on this solitary retreat that I really wish was over. But all the time in the world to be with this pain in my knee. And even though something in you is saying, no, I haven't, I want it to be over, this planting that suggestion in the mind, raising that as a possibility, saying, no, I have got all the time in the world. It's touching into that intuitive wisdom that realizes, yes, there is all the time in the world to be with this uncomfortable feeling. It's exactly this way. So that it's to do with not getting hit by the second arrow. So the first arrow, in that analogy of the Buddha, the first arrow is the painful feeling. And as the Buddha pointed out, as long as you're alive, if you have a body and a mind, then nobody can avoid being hit by the first arrow. The physical pain is an inescapable part of existence. But the second arrow is all of the negotiating, worrying, resenting, regretting, hoping, fearing, that clusters around that painful feeling. And that second arrow is avoidable. And and I think it's important to recognize that when we talk about the end of suffering, it's all about the second arrow, not the first arrow. That when we talk about dukkha nirodha, it's not never having physical pain or never having an uncomfortable emotional state like sadness or grief or such like, but rather the end of suffering, the end of dukkha, is never being hit by that second arrow, the mind not creating any kind of problem, any kind of difficulty, any agitation around those painful feelings. And so that during that retreat, I think Ajahn Chandasiri will probably remember that Lumpur would say over and over again, all the time in the world to be with this painful feeling, all the time in the world to be with this ache in my back, all the time in the world just to be here and to be aware of this. And it's really a helpful encouragement, because the instinctual habit is to be waiting for the bell, waiting to get out and do the walking, waiting to get in from the walking to go and sit, waiting for the retreat to be over, waiting for the retreat to begin, and the mind creating this promise off in the future of something that's different or better than this, you know, that which is more real, more valuable, more comfortable, more pleasing than this. And so that's that radical, creation of restlessness. That is more valuable, more real than this. And so this quality of patience and letting go of a future, opening the heart to the timeless quality of Dhamma, it's a cutting at that very root of restlessness. It's saying, no, that is not more interesting or valuable or real than this, that there's only this, that there isn't really a that over the horizon, that promised thing off in the future where I don't have this pain or I don't have to live with this difficult person or I've solved this particular problem or paid off this debt or got out of this difficult job. That no, it's the Dhamma is here and now. It's not over there. It's ever present. And so that letting go of the future, letting go of time, is also, say, cutting the root of that quality of udaccha or restlessness, that way that the mind easily leans towards the promise of a that is somehow more valuable, more real, more substantial, more satisfying than this. It's overlooking what's here, what's present, in order to say to take refuge in the promise of that, or the worrying about the threat of that over there, and so that the effect of letting go of time and letting there be no future, it opens the heart, helps the direct realization of that quality of presence. So any thoughts, reflections, comments? Venerable Narindo, yes.
Yeah, I have to think about what
all
I want to say.
All the time in the world to ask your question.
Sorry?
You've got all the time in the world to ask Thank you. Your question.
what you were just saying about enduring or looking at the pain. You know, when I just started here years ago, then you have this kind of idea what it meant, right? Like what you're now making a difference between, it's different than gritting with your teeth. But I guess you have to go through that before you figure out what is the difference between one and the other. And,
sure, yes.
Right? So now after a few years, then I'm meeting, you know, quite a few different monks or different people and their experience and then how they share what they had gone through. Like, for instance, pain in the knee. When is it a real pain, meaning like biologically that it's damaging? And when is it sort of you being a wimp, basically, or something like, yeah, you're just getting into your mind and you just give up, basically, and stand up. And I found it very difficult to find that it's not like black-white and there's mm-hmm. two sentences, you read that and you understand what to do. It seems like a trial and error. And but it does concern me because, for instance, after coming back from Thailand, you hear stories from, let's say, Western monks staying in Thailand for many years there, and that by now they have screwed up their knees completely, can't walk up a stair anymore, staircase. They're like 20 pansa, 30 pansa, or they have been eating very quickly. And now they have like acid reflux and, you know, their stomachs are a bit not working properly. And or when I come back here, or like actually in the last few years, I see in Thailand and also here, there are more people in chairs. I just wondering what you would advise. Like, I understand what you just said, and you know, that's conceptually, that's correct, I would say. But how do you advise more like on the practical level, like what is harmful physiologically, yeah, that one. And when is it just, you know, bear with it, basically, and you're in the mind. Like, one of the other things is what was kind of surprising to me, for instance, yourself, but Ajahn Jayasaro, Longpo Samedo, Ajahn Yanadamo, they have this kind of skin cancer on their head. And when you're in Thailand, you might think, okay, you just walk in the sun, it's hot, you know, you're sweeping the whole day, every day, like an hour or two. Yeah, endure it, right? Endure the heat, endure the thing. But it's also the other thing, like, oh, should I be worried or concerned, put sunblock on me or not, you know? But then if you have these senior monks having all that, let's say, skin issues, let's say, then you start sort of, how does that work? You know, like, where do you start, let's say, worry about something and then take action on it? And when do you say, oh, that's just worry. Worry about death, worry about sickness, which is in some way very, you can't avoid that, basically. So I just thought maybe you have some thoughts about this. You know, having grown up with the Sangha, I've seen many, many people with, I guess, many things, right?
Yes, good, good question. There's a few different elements in there. The kind of instruction that I usually give with, because I've taught a lot of meditation retreats and given a lot of meditation guidance, and mostly in the West, having done most of my monastic training in the West, also being around people who've been overzealous with the meditations and sort of pushing through painful feelings, or oftentimes the injuries come from people doing over-enthusiastic yoga exercises, it's not so much with the overextended sittings, but sometimes yoga or physical exercise that people have damaged themselves. So often the way that we harm our bodies in that respect is sort of leading with the head. You know, that we have an idealistic view of how we should be or how we want to be, or I've decided that I will do this kind of, I'll get into the lotus posture. One former monk here was actually badly damaged his knee, demonstrating to a layperson that, now this is what you never want to do when you cross your legs. And he did it on purpose, but he was trying to demonstrate, well, you know, this is the way you should never do it, thinking that he wouldn't do any harm, but he actually wrecked his knee quite seriously, demonstrating how it shouldn't be done. So it's painful irony, a brutal irony on that one. So that sense of leading with the head, having an ideal of how we should be or how we want to be or how long we're going to sit for, often that, even though it's well-intentioned and can be, you know, based on a noble aspiration, it can often lead to physical damage, one kind or another. And that... So what I would encourage is the standard that following from Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumedha's instruction would be to, if you're feeling discomfort in the meditation, I don't really talk about what sort of exercise people should do or what kind of yoga postures and such like. Usually I leave that for people to decide for themselves. But in the sitting meditation, what I would say is when you start to feel discomfort in your knees or your back, then for at least a few minutes, stay with that feeling and bring your attention to it. So Lumpur Cha would often say, you know, rather than thinking of the pain as an interruption of your meditation, you know, if it's getting your attention, then let go of the breath and make the painful feeling in your knee, make that the object of meditation. And so then for a few minutes, just use that painful feeling as a meditation object. And to see to what degree you can let go of it. Just let the feeling be there and not add anything to it. So that, because if you change your posture as soon as you get uncomfortable, then you're always shifting, and then you also never learned to work with painful feelings, physical or mental. You know, you tend to be conditioning a reactive pattern and an inability to know dukkha, at least on a physical pain level, that it's like avoiding dukkha rather than transcending dukkha, because you're always trying to shift away from it. And so that when the time comes and you can't shift away from it, you haven't really developed the skills of what to do, what's the helpful attitude to have when dukkha is unavoidable, when it's not a matter of a particular posture, it's just, you know, this thing is damaged, this thing is hurting, this thing is painful, irrespective of what posture you're in. So what I encourage people is to give at least a few minutes to investigate that painful feeling. And then to quite consciously use the intuitive wisdom. So to say, bring the attention to that feeling And then to consider, okay, this is uncomfortable. Now, is there the sense, do the signals say, okay, now something is really being damaged or is on the is soon to be damaged? Or is it just the signals saying, this is uncomfortable, but no harm is really being done, nothing is really being stretched or compromised in any significant way? And that's going to be different for everybody, and that's that sense of intuitive wisdom is going to be accessible to different degrees by different people, and again, it's going to be trustworthy to different degrees for different people. But I feel that that's the most helpful quality to develop. So in a way, you're listening to your body, using the wisdom of the body itself, and so that then, in a way, using the intelligence of the body that sort of has its own ordering system. It kind of knows when it's being damaged or it knows when it's being stretched. There's an intuitive sense of that I feel that we have, and experience shows that there's a lot of that within our own sort of physiology that helps the body to be protected. So when there is that sense of, okay, that knee is really under some pressure, so it's time to change the posture. And then what I like to talk about that, and I feel helps a great deal, is to then stay with that painful feeling until there is that sense of, okay, now it's good to change the posture. Things are really getting stretched, strained here. But to make sure that the motivation to move is based on kindness for the body rather than aversion to the pain. So if you've done retreats with me or heard me give this kind of advice probably a number of times, but I feel that's a really important element of it. So the motivation for moving is kindness and attunement to the body's limits rather than I hate this pain, I want to get away from it, based on self-view and aversion. And so that I've always felt it's quite okay to change the posture, and you know, Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Someda would say the same thing. So neither of them were, you know, make a resolution and absolutely, you know, do not budge from this, you know, hell or high water. Both of those ajahns would tend to be allowing of a changing of posture most of the time. And then what you find is that if you change the posture based on kindness and attunement to the body, then it has a very peaceful result. You change the posture, there's a relief from the pain, and the mind is quite calm and at ease. If you change the posture based on fear and aversion and self-view, then what tends to happen is, oh, thank goodness that's over. And then you're setting yourself up for, oh no, it's come back again. Oh, the other knee now. Oh dear. And you're creating the causes for more agitation, more dukkha. So that by using that methodology of not moving until you can come from a place of kindness and attunement, then right there you're planting the causes for peacefulness and calmness. Also, another thing in terms of the physical pain, and going back to the teaching of the two arrows, which I like to emphasize, is that often there's a physical tension that's being created in the body. Like if you have a pain in your knee or a pain in your back, you tend to tense up against it. You resist that pain and bring more tension into the body. So along with bringing attention to the area where you're feeling the physical pain, to notice the tightness in the muscles around that area and to consciously relax, just to let the whole system soften and be as relaxed as possible. Because often, even though we tense up in a way of resisting the pain, that very tension tends to generate more pain. And the more that the system can be relaxed, then the causes of those painful feelings are often, reduced or disappear altogether. And so that way of relating to physical pain is what I tend to teach that, and I encourage that. So I appreciate there's large numbers of members of the Sangha who wrecked their knees or their backs or other parts of their bodies through one reason or another. But I find that using that kind of a guidance, I'm not making any claims, but I haven't had anybody come back to me and say that was lousy advice or that didn't help. But so I think for most people that seems to be kind of on the mark, and it's both helping to encourage the quality of patience, learning patience based on letting go and relaxation and mindfulness of the body, so that you are developing the ability to be with painful feelings, but that being with the painful feeling is based on an attunement to Dhamma, to nature, rather than just gritting your teeth and bearing the pain, no matter how extreme it gets. So I found that a fairly reliable approach myself. In terms of things like melanoma or skin cancer, and I was diagnosed with melanoma, I think it was, let's see, I arrived in California in June, and I was diagnosed in June of 96. I was diagnosed with melanoma in October of 96. So that was July, August, September. So 4 months after I arrived in sunny California, you know, congratulations, you've got melanoma. I mean, I'd acquired it earlier on, but I was only diagnosed. So I could have said, okay, California's not for me. I should move out and just let somebody else start this monastery. But I had some good medical advisors there. There was a melanoma clinic one of the two melanoma clinics in the U.S. was in San Francisco. And there was one of the board of directors for the monastery was a doctor, and there was a good dermatologist in the local town. One of the Anagarikas was a nurse. So I had plenty of good advice. So I learned the right kind of sunscreen to use, and I was given a handy broad-brimmed hat and sun gloves, and got used to putting on lots of sunscreen and being aware of where the sun is in the sky and how to gear up to not let the sun touch your skin. So, you know, and those kind of things, you make your choices. I could have said, okay, I'm going back to cloudy northern England, up in the northern latitudes. You know, we're at the 52nd parallel here, and so that right now, you know, the sun at midday is just over the top of the trees here in southern England, and even in midsummer, it's not that high up in the sky, so the sun is never particularly strong here. So I could have said, okay, I'll just go back to the northern latitudes and be out of the sun, but it seemed like, okay, I can gear up, I can wear a hat, I can wear sungloves, I can put on sunscreen with titanium dioxide in it to protect me, and let's see if things work out. And I stayed melanoma free since then, so it worked out. But those kind of things, you make your choices, and what's the priority for you? And as like Lumpo Cha would say, well, you know, even the doctors get ill. Even the dentists have teeth problems. You know, that you can do everything possible to look after a particular illness or an ailment or a disability. But in the long run, you're always you're going to have to deal with something. And that that's the nature of the body. And so basically you do the best with the conditions as you experience them, and you make your choices as to what the priorities are. So, some people choose to take more rest or take more medicine or have more medical treatment. Other people refuse to take much rest, don't want to see a doctor, and they just let the system get affected by different conditions or illnesses. That's the choices they make. So I think it's up to each individual to how much they want to actively work with illnesses or injuries and ailments. And then you receive the results of your choices, you know, kama sukomi, you are the heir of our karma. So many people observe that Lumpo Cha, his health caving in at the age of 63, 64, that it was a great tragedy that he didn't live longer or couldn't teach longer. But he made his own choices to be like available for anybody and everybody for 15, 18 hours a day, every day, for 30 or 40 years. He made that choice. And that was entirely his prerogative. Other people run their lives very differently. But I feel that, again, it's an intuitive thing. For myself, I don't really plan very much what I do and how I use my time. I just sort of play it by ear. And whatever feels right, what feels like a good fit, that's what I go along with. I don't have a fixed program that I've created for myself. But I feel that that's up to each one of us to find that what's a good fit for how much time we concern ourselves with our health issues, how often we pursue treatment, those kind of things are, are very individual. For myself, I'm not particularly inclined to visit doctors. I only just got signed on with the local surgery here a few weeks ago after having been in the UK for 10 years. Finally got persuaded to sign on with a GP. But I haven't seen a doctor. I haven't been treated by a doctor in this country for 10 years. Various ailments and aches and pains come and go, but I'm not one who particularly inclines to seek treatment or have anxieties about different things that pop up myself. Other people are different, and I think it's up to each one of us to make our choices, and then we receive the results of the choices that we make. So that's a long answer to a short question. Yes. Can you get the microphone?
Hi, I was just wondering if you could talk about the other side of the coin of the value of asceticism.
The value of what?
I only ever read the word asceticism.
Asceticism.
Yeah, sorry. I've only ever read the word, I think. Mm-hmm. But the value of sort of putting yourself in a box and shaking it and seeing what happens.
We're part of the forest tradition here, and that contains a lot of that. Putting it in a box and shaking it and see what happens. And the Buddha allowed 13 different ascetic practices. So in our tradition, the forest tradition, we actively use quite a few of those. Some of them are much more, people follow them according to their individual choices. But it can be things like eating all of your food from a single bowl, just eating one time a day, not lying down to sleep, only using three postures, sitting, standing, and walking, only eating the food you get on the arms round, these kind of things. So that those kind of ascetic practices, the Buddha didn't allow any kind of self-torture, like vowing to stand on one leg for a year, or vowing to only eat three grains of rice a day, or such like. He didn't encourage that kind of what's called self-mortification or also self-punishment. So the kind of ascetic practices he allowed were to do with clothing. Like, you just one of the ascetic practices is just to wear only having the basic robes and not using any other kind of clothing, not sleeping in a building, like sleeping at the under a tree, that's using the shelter of a root of a tree, camping out in a tent or under an umbrella or mosquito net, just eating one time a day. Only eating the food that you get given in the village, as I said, not lying down to sleep. So they're all things that impact the sort of powerfully instinctual areas, like physical comfort, food, sleep, and territory, like having your own, not having your own kuti, or just sort of living out under a tree. So that they're all things that there's a very strong instinctual impulse for. Territory, comfort, food, sleep. And so it's ways of sort of gently but firmly making an inroad into those kind of mind states. So, I mean, the food discipline that we have, like the not eating between noon and dawn of the next day, that's a standard part of our vinaya. That's not an ascetic practice, but you can make a resolution just to eat one meal a day. And so then there's and I usually do that every year for about 6 months of the year. In the cold months I have a breakfast, but from about April or May through till November, then I just have the one meal. I don't have any breakfast, just a couple of cups of tea in the morning. And so every day at 11 o'clock, I'm feeling hungry, you know, so that you get to experience that feeling of hunger. It's much more pronounced. Or nowadays, just before breakfast, I notice a certain rumble. So that you can investigate that feeling of hunger. And the practice of not lying down to sleep, I did that for about three years or so. So when I first came here to Amravati, so from about 1983 to the end of 86, I didn't lie down for those 3 years. And so you get to understand sleepiness. Also, you ache so much, there's no comfortable posture, at least I found, there's no comfortable posture. You're always aching, whatever you're doing. And so that was, you give up trying to get away from the uncomfortable feeling, because wherever, whatever posture you're in, it's always uncomfortable. And so those kind of practices, the sort of ascetic, allowable ascetic practices, they are helping you to deal with things that there's a strong instinctual aversion to, like not wanting to be hungry, not wanting to be uncomfortable, not wanting to be sleepy, these kind of not quite brainstem, but sort of certainly reptile brain functions, that you're challenging those so that you know you can be hungry and be completely at peace with it. You can be sleepy and be completely at peace with it. You can be uncomfortable. You can be, you know, aching all over, and you can be at peace with it. And so that's the purpose of those kind of practices, is to help to develop adaptability so that you're learning how not to create suffering around being a little bit hungry or a lot hungry, or if you're a bit hot or a bit cold, you can be at peace with that. So it's helping one to be robust, you know, like you can be comfortable in all situations. Because if we're always looking for, say, having enough sleep, enough food, enough, you know, and living in having the clothes that we like, or having our own living space exactly as we like, then we tend to take refuge in having everything a certain way. And when it's not that way, then the mind easily creates suffering. That second arrow is really a lot of second arrows that come in. And so that those kind of austerities, those ascetic practices, they're really helpful in learning to develop strength and adaptability around those very instinctual areas: food, sleep, territory, comfort, in particular. And so that the Buddha said that I forget where the reference is, but somewhere along the way, the Buddha said there's several reasons why people monastics would follow ascetic practices or take up ascetic practices. One would be because everyone around them is doing it, so you know you do it too. Another one is to impress the lay people, so they'll think that you're a great yogi. Another one is to think that you're automatically generating good karma by carrying out these austerities, or you're automatically burning off bad karma because of these austerities. And then the fifth one is for the sake of simplicity. And then he said the only reason of these five that is actually worth following is the fifth one, is for the sake of simplicity. The other reasons are all very worldly and not to be pursued. So simplicity meaning that if it's hot, you're okay. If it's cold, you're okay. If you're hungry, it's okay. If you're full, you're okay. If you're alert and awake, you're okay. If you're sleepy and exhausted, you're okay. So the mind learns to have a very peaceful and non-contentious attitude with those sort of core survival aspects. Well, not kind of survival as in not breathing or not eating at all, but those kind of instinctual areas, sort of reptile brain areas around food, sleep, comfort, territory, and so forth. So that, but you can get attached to ascetic practice, even though it's for the sake of simplicity. You can make your life very complicated with your with having too many ascetic practices, or the taking them too seriously and driving the people who you live with nuts with your austerity program. That it's making things simple for you, but it's making things complicated for everybody around you. So that you have to be alert to keeping those things in balance. And both Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Sumato, they would be very, very skillful in helping to guide people. Because a part of our tradition is, if you're a junior person in particular, you should always ask the one of the elders permission, or the acharya, wherever you're living. You know, I want to take on this particular ascetic practice of just eating once a day, or never lying down, or just living on going on the bindabat, going to the alms round to the local town and just living on the food from the town for a week or a month. And then the elder will say, I think that's a good idea, but just do it for a week, or okay, you can try it out, but let me know how it's going. And or no, I don't think it's a good idea for you. You know, if someone says, yeah, I want to to carry out this particular kind of practice, and you think, yeah, they're already sort of wound very, very tight, and so rather than adding on an extra layer of rigor, for this particular person, they need to relax more and lighten up and just not be so not so kind of ardent, that there's too much I should, I must, I've got to, I want to. And that even though that sense of enthusiasm or interest is skillful, if it gets into the area of compulsiveness or obsessiveness, or then it becomes obstructive. So then one has to use wisdom in relationship to those things. Yes, Venerable Nidaro. Can you pass on the microphone?
Yes. I was wondering, Ajahn, for the purpose of liberation, do you think it's necessary to...
For the purpose of what?
Liberation, liberating the mind. Do you think it's necessary to do some ascetic practices at times, or do you think it's possible for some people to follow a route of just going the comfortable way and kind of, you know, always eating when they want to eat and obviously within the rules, or sleeping when they want to sleep, and but maybe reflecting in a way that kind of they can still see through things in a way? Or do you think one has to, how necessary do you think it is to do?
It's totally individual. Everyone's different. you can't generalize, really. I think for some people, it's a really helpful tool. For somebody else, it's of no particular value or impact whatsoever. So everyone varies. People are all different. Life tends to present quite an adequate supply of tests, I would say. There's no disagreement, I think. There's along the way, you get plenty of challenges. Even when you're trying to live in a very sort of moderate and or unspecial, without a special program. And So paying attention to the areas where you are being challenged. Like, you might not be practicing any austerities, but you might have a lot of problem with all the noise the monk in the next room is making. Yeah. It's not a chosen ascetic practice, but it's a challenge. Or that you dinged your knee a few weeks or months ago. Like, that wasn't an ascetic practice, but it was an austerity. You had to develop mindfulness of the damage that was done. You've still got a surgery lined up at some point. And so, you know, life provides an adequate supply of challenges, and that it's the skill is often in recognizing, oh, this is something to learn from, rather, oh, this is like if only I hadn't got this knee, then I could practice properly. Like, no. This is your ajahn, you know, that's the practice, is dealing with the dodgy knee. That's your teacher. And that it's sort of keeping an eye open for those areas where the mind gets carried away, excited about this or irritated by that, and that was also something I learned very directly from Lumpo Sumedho, because in that era when I was doing the sitter's practice, I was sort of a compulsive ascetic, ascetic compulsive disorder. I just thought of that. So. I just had so many things going on. I felt like one of those poor geese that was sort of stuffed full to make foie gras, you know, this sort of overfed goose that's kind of, I was stuffed full of ascetic practices, kind of overfed with austerities. And Lumpo Sumedho was kind of waiting for me to get the point that, yeah, just be normal. That you don't have to be doing all this stuff, just, be a monk, you know, get up in the morning, come to the chanting, you know, eat your meal, carry out the work around the monastery, go to bed at night. That's all that you need. Don't be kind of making all this extra layers of stuff to be doing on top of it. So it took me quite a while to get that. And I felt that, because also Lumpo Sumedho and, you know, Lumpo Cha in turn had their own times of very intense austerity, and had in similar ways had really invested a lot in, you know, doing all these serious practices and enduring a lot of pain and difficulty. And, you know, there's benefit that comes from that, but also seeing that that is not intrinsically liberating. You know, the pain is not liberating. It's a skillful means, and that if the mind is sort of taking the practice itself, the austerity itself is liberating, then you've got the wrong end of the stick. But just enduring pain is not intrinsically beneficial or liberating. It's just pain. And I think a few weeks ago I was quoting this. When I was in New York City one time, there was this large billboard advertising the U.S. Marines, like, you know, join the Marines, and it had a picture of this sort of wooden wall on an assault course, and you could see this sort of shaven-headed soldier with the hands gripping the top of the wall, and this agonized look on their face, and the caption was, "Pain is the experience of weakness leaving. Join the Marines." You know. And I thought, no, that's completely wrong view. Pain is the experience of pain. You know, there's nothing intrinsically virtuous to it. So I realize I'm on camera and this is being recorded. So I have nothing against the U.S. Marines personally, but I feel that was a particular slogan used in the advertising that didn't really sit in accord with Dhamma as we understand it. Ajahn Chandrasiri, you've got a comment to make, a question?
I was just going to say that when I first became a nun, people would ask what was the most difficult thing to give up. And immediately the answer was having my own way. and as you were saying earlier about just how life itself presents you with plenty of things to work with, that was one thing I was going to say. The other thing I was going to say was about patience. And I think one of the elements that I find very helpful to consider in terms of cultivating patience is that, like, willingness, just a willingness to be with whatever it is that is happening. Because impatience is like wanting to move on to the next thing, whereas just saying, okay, I'm willing to be with this. So it's like saying yes. Not that you want it or you want more of it, but you're willing to be with
it. Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah. Willing is...
That works better for me than having no future.
Yeah, no, that's a very good way of putting it. I remember Sister Tania, remember from New Zealand, Sister Tania, that years ago she was co-leading. We were co-leading a retreat together in the States, and she talked about that quality of willingness and being willing as a sort of a real essence of the paramita in that way. There's an openness there. It's like, okay. A kind of a readiness to be with the way things are, and that and so that there's a letting go of preferences or preoccupation, and a readiness, even though you might think it's perhaps beyond your capacity. It's like there's that to be willing is you're ready to give it a go, or to do your best, and just to surrender. You know, kind of surrendering self concern and self-interest.
I like it because it feels more active in some ways. You know, it's an active going towards something, but not necessarily approving. Because I think there also has to be a kind of intelligence there that can see if, you know, if there is something incredibly painful, if there is a possibility of doing something about it, then you do that. It's not just being willing to stay with it, just as you were saying before, for the sake of it, or so like a balance of qualities.
Yes, yeah, it's like a readiness to meet what's present. Is that what you're? Yes,
kind of. I mean, I remember in very old days. Somebody saying, yes, like, I really need to be with this grumpy mood. So if I was, you know, trying to kind of, I don't know, suggest ways of improving things, and this person said, no, I need to stay with this grumpy mood. And you think, well, actually, you don't have to stay with it. But it's allowing things to change, not holding on to a really difficult state.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Just for the sake of it, but
yeah, I think that sometimes we can hang on to things and sort of freeze conditions in place because I've got to work with this,
yeah.
And that, but which has got a noble and skillful intention behind it. But what can be happening is the mind is actually sustaining this, like. And that when it's sort of living its lifespan and fading out, then you can still be hanging on to it, or even sort of sustaining it when it's actually sort of fading away. And that, or we can have the idea, there's this problem I really need to work on. And certain times that you do, but maybe it's not always there, or it's losing its strength. But you keep sustaining it because of the idea that this is my problem and I've got to work on it. And so we can be unconsciously maintaining difficult situations without really being aware that it's our attitude that's feeding it and keeping it alive, and not just letting it be coming to a natural end. Speaking of natural endings, 7 o'clock has come around already, so let's finish there for today. So tomorrow's the day before OnePra, so there won't be a reading for the next couple of days.